This is the Hugo Award winning SF Signal podcast. John, I want my cookie. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm your host. Well, tonight I'm your co-host because I got Jame here. And as usual, I get to tease Jame and have some fun and just dig a little bit deeper into that hole that I've been building with her for at least, what, 4 or 5 years now, Jame? I don't know, something like that.
I'm pretty sure at this point you're coming out on the other side of the globe.
But yes.
Sure, keep digging.
Yep, I know, keep digging. Anyway, this is the SF Signal podcast, and Jame is here. So that means we're going to be talking about bigger things, bigger topics. And she's going to do all the heavy lifting, which is awesome because that means I can just sit here and drink my sweet tea.
Which is kind of cool.
What's our topic?
Our topic tonight is urban fantasy. So we'll be digging into the many shapes that takes, the literary side, media, gaming, and all of the little cracks in between, and its use as kind of a gateway drug. And I will probably get crucified by the court of the internet for that term. but I'm Jame Gates. What?
I talked to your boss.
I'm sorry.
Over at SIFWA.
If you can get him to fire me, please go ahead.
We actually shared some wonderful stories about you. Were your ears burning?
I'm sure.
Were your ears burning?
They're always burning. Someone is always talking about something awful that I've done, which most of the time I haven't even actually done.
He was telling us over the Functional Nerds. He was telling us a story about Jim. To everybody else, it's Sir Mr. James Cameron, but to Stephen, it's Jim.
Yeah, it's always fun to have a meeting with Steve that's, oh yeah, I'm just sitting here in Hollywood in Jim's office, uh-huh. And there's all this art I can't show you because, you know, it's for stuff that doesn't exist yet, and you know, there's this light up statue of the Na'vi and it's really creepy, and it's like, yes.
Yeah.
And he has absolutely no intention behind it, whatever it is. We're all just sitting there like, we hate you so much.
Well,
we hate you so much.
I actually thanked him for John Klima.
Yes.
So there. Anyway, who's Jame?
I don't know. You cut her off. Apparently you don't want to hear about her.
That's okay.
I'm an editor and author. My most current work is the anthology War Stories, which is going to be, well, the ebook is for sale and the print copy will be available early next week. The Kickstarter backers have their copies for the most part now, so that's coming out soon. I'm also the communications director for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. In theory, that means I work with all the different genres. Mostly, it just means that I send a lot of emails.
Yes, you do. And you'll send them, and then you'll send another one, or you'll tweet somebody saying, did Gmail eat that?
Mm-hmm.
Did it go? Did you
no,
get
that's
it?
Just your emails.
Yeah. Well, Google doesn't like my email for some reason.
Or it doesn't like you.
I know. But yeah, it's cool that you do all that stuff. And your anthology, your latest one, I think, is also you and Andrew. Are you and Andrew doing something together?
Yes. That's what War Stories is. Andrew Liptak and I edited that together. Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, you're about to do an interview on SF Signal about that.
Yes. I actually just got the questions from Charles like an hour ago, so I have to do those and all that stuff. But my brain is still recovering from sending in 5,000 words of RPG writing last night, and it doesn't want to do any more words.
Yeah, never think that I don't already know.
Oh, I know you do, busybody.
And you have wrangled people for tonight.
I have.
So who do you want to introduce first?
Let's go ahead and throw Rose under the bus first.
Rose, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Hi, I'm Rose Bailey. I'm a writer and game designer. For nearly the last decade, I've been the developer on White Wolf's vampire role-playing game. More recently, I've taken over the demon role-playing game. And I've also recently published a collection of shall we say, Robert E. Howard meets Brothers Grimm fairy tales. It's called The Sugar House, The Adventures of Sasha Witchblood. You can find it on Kindle. You can find it on Nook. And print on demand will be coming soon.
I have a photograph of the game that you're talking about, the White Wolf game, of the poster, like the launch poster for that game. It's
which
it's,
one?
It's in a game shop. It's from 92 or 94 or something like that, or maybe 84. I don't know. But it's in this game shop down in Colorado Springs. They've got it up on the wall there in a frame. It's pretty cool.
Is that the Oh My God, What Have I Become poster?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
But I actually took a picture of it and sent it to Chuck Wendig and Merle Lafferty because I think they had both at some point or another had worked with White Wolf.
Chuck did a lot of work for White Wolf. He was an extremely prolific freelancer for a number of years before he basically got too awesome for us.
Yeah, it sucks when that happens.
Yeah, he grew a beard. That's what happened.
No, he had the beard all along. The beard is the source of his power.
Oh, so we need to just hold him down and shave it off.
Ooh.
Chuck is phenomenal.
Yeah.
One of my favorite writers to talk with, one of my favorite writers to work with.
Very cool. Yeah, he's a lot of fun. I like him. Which brings us to Michael.
It's true. I also work with Chuck Wendig. I'm Michael R. Underwood. I'm an author, and my day job working with Chuck Wendig, among many, many other wonderful authors, is as the North American Sales and Marketing Manager at Angry Robot.
Angry Robot.
The gift that keeps on giving. I don't even have to pay for that anymore.
Nope. I swear to God, I've sang that song more times than John and Elio.
It's true. And he like goes back over those things a ton. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you've sung more is definitely notable.
Yep.
Yeah, most of my novels are urban fantasy. I've got a comedic urban fantasy series called the Re-Reyes books, where fandom and geekdom is turned into a magic system. And I have an upcoming supernatural thriller urban fantasy called The Younger Gods, which is coming out on October 13th, which is much more in the darker end of the genre. So I have a little bit of range, even within urban fantasy. Very happy to be here.
Very cool. And Rose, did you have a website you want to tell people about?
Yes. www.fantasyheartbreaker.com.
And are you on social media?
I am. I'm Rose on Mars on Twitter and Rose Bailey on Google+.
Very cool. And Michael, what about you?
I'm at michaelrunderwood.com and on Twitter at @MikeRUnderwood.
Very cool. And James, what are we going to talk about tonight with urban fantasy? Do you want to talk about the Dresden Files? Do you want to talk about the Dresden Files? Because I can talk about the Dresden Files.
So there, I don't know if anyone's heard of this thing called the Dresden Files, but we'll definitely not be talking about that tonight because no one on this podcast knows anything about it from what I can tell. So where we're going to start out is we'll let Patrick talk for a minute about the Dresden Files. Otherwise, he won't stop all evening.
I love the Dresden Files. They're funny.
I hear there's a kind of a cool game of the Dresden Files, too.
There is. Yes.
I haven't played it. I haven't either. I have it, but I haven't played it. I'm really bad about that. But what I wanted to start off talking about was kind of the history of urban fantasy, because in a lot of ways, it's one of the more recent subgenres to come out. But it also traces way, way back to some of the early stuff. You know, in a way, even Frankenstein was kind of urban fantasy. A lot of it draws from Dracula. So I kind of just want to talk about the evolution of vampires and werewolves and the tropes of urban fantasy, and then start looking at some of the new places it's going with works like what Michael is working on and some of the new games that are coming out.
What do you consider to be urban fantasy? Because there's a lot of different like subgenres, or there's a lot of different names that people are throwing out there. Urban fantasy, contemporary fantasy. I mean, what is urban fantasy to you?
I am going to ask our esteemed guests that, actually.
Okay.
So,
Michael, yes. Go.
Okay, so for me, urban fantasy is a particular subgenre of contemporary fantasy, which has, in a rather drow method of advancement style, killed its former superior and taken its place, so that urban fantasy, from a marketing perspective, for many people has become the kind of top level categorization in contemporary fantasy and or fantasy set in cities, because sometimes we talk about urban fantasy and it's historical. So for me, there's a lot of kind of border bleed, and it's gotten kind of muddled. But for the most part, I think of urban fantasy as being located in cities and coming from a certain thread of narratives that have come together where it tends to favor first-person POV, female protagonist, and encompasses a wide range of existing folklore, integrating it into the narrative. Now, there's a lot of differences, but that's kind of the core of the genre as I see it.
Rose, do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good assessment.
Okay, so so let me ask you this. If I write a story about a witch who is fighting vampires in the hills and hollers of rural Kentucky, does that in 2014, does that qualify as urban fantasy? If they never go to a city?
I think that while denotatively urban fantasy doesn't encompass that, I think you're going to find that a story like that has more in common with what we shelve as urban fantasy than it does with other genres.
Okay.
Well, and with any genre, you're going to end up with a lot of bleed and crossover. I mean, the emergence of science fantasy is a really good example of that. So with urban fantasy, we're starting to maybe need to use the category title of modern fantasy. I think that's a little more encompassing, but there's also still that very strong core genre of, you know, Kim Harrison, Patricia Briggs, the modern paranormal fantasy sort of group.
So,
that is what most people think of and then branches from there.
Is it about being in a modern times, though? I mean, could you take a Patricia Briggs story, set it in a castle in Western Europe that is essentially a city, right? In the far, far, far past, could you do that and still call that urban fantasy?
I would call that historical fantasy.
Yeah, that's what I'd call it, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Understood.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of those things that genre is largely the creation of those of us who work in marketing, and for that I apologize deeply. As much as I hate it, it is true. You can't really get too wound up in any sort of label either, and I think that maybe this is one of the best examples of that. You look at the issue we had recently with paranormal romance and urban fantasy going, ew, get it off of us, that's not part of this, and because that's what everyone thought urban fantasy was for a while, was you were out banning the werewolf.
Am I not?
I mean, you might be, but there are a fair number of urban fantasy authors who are like, no, we're writing these amazing non-sexual, non-werewolf baning books. Can we please have a little more, you know, nuance to it than that?
Well, look, I work on a role-playing game about modern vampires, and I will tell you that 90% of it is about bad dating.
Yes, you have a point.
So why we were chatting and setting up the idea of urban fantasy, we did have other people who were invited to the podcast, and one of them has shown up a little bit late.
Yay!
And that is Greg. So Greg, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Sorry, cable problems, first of all. Hi, my name is Greg Bannycout. I am a writer. Was that a hiss?
No, I don't think it was a hiss.
Okay, sorry. My current project is the urban fantasy trilogy called California Bones. The first volume is also called California Bones. It is about wizards who get their powers from eating the remains of magical creatures like dragons and griffins and whatnot. And it takes place in Southern California. And sorry, that's it. Because I came in late, I'm a little...
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah. So, what's your website?
Website is writingandsnacks.com. You can see me on Twitter at Greg Vaneekout.
And Eek Out is E-E-K-O-U-T?
It's E-E-K-H-O-U-T. H is somewhat silent.
Okay, gotcha. And so we've been talking a little bit about urban fantasy. We just set up what the premise of urban fantasy is. And now James is going to ask you, Greg, a really hard question.
Let's go for it.
What's your definition of urban fantasy, and where does it start running into other genres?
Yeah, well, urban fantasy, and you guys have probably already said the obvious thing, it's a marketing category. It is a definition that publishing gave us.
Look, I already apologized for this once, guys.
But that's essentially true. That's essentially true. Because why is Lord of the Rings not urban fantasy when Gondor is a city, you know?
That was my point, yes.
That's an excellent point. You know, its roots actually go back when we can actually start thinking of it as a publishing category in recent times. It had a sort of genesis in the 80s, the Minnesota group of writers, Charles DeLint and Emma Bull. Did we cover that?
Nope. Well,
no, we haven't talked about War for the Oaks at all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So there was this sort of burst of urban fantasy in the 80s, and it was War of the Oaks and with Megan Lindholm, who is now Robin Hobb, Wizard of the Pigeons. The Borderlands group of books that were written by Will Shetterly and again Emma Bull and Charles DeLint and a group of associated writers. And then, in the 90s and the aughts, it kind of had a resurgence and became a definite publishing category where we actually started talking about urban fantasy as a subgenre. But I think it goes further back than that, definitely. If you think about the stories of Ray Bradbury, especially the short stories of Ray Bradbury, a lot of them took place in urban environments. And there's a story that he wrote called The Crowd, which could not have taken place in anything but an urban environment because it's about the anonymity of large groups of people, which you can't have in a rural setting, and you really can't have in a remote setting. So it required the urban element to actually make that work as a fantasy. And if you think back of maybe like Twilight Zone, so many of the stories...
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension, a dimension of sight, a dimension of sound, a dimension of mind. You're moving through a place of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Holy crap, is Rod Serling just joined the podcast?
That was kind of creepy and awesome.
I wasn't even doing the Rod Serling voice.
You weren't doing the Rod Serling voice, but he was here, man.
which was an awesome show, and it was an anthology show, which you don't even see anymore.
No, they don't do well. They get canceled.
Mm. Yeah.
Even when they try to remake Twilight Zone. Go ahead, Rose.
I was just going to say, I think that that Greg is absolutely right. There's a strong tradition that goes back further than the 80s of fantasy stories that are deeply rooted in urban environments. My favorite American author, period, is Fritz Leiber. And in 1977, I think he did Our Lady of Darkness, which is a fantasy story which couldn't really take place anywhere else except an American city.
Interesting. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example.
And then even before that, I think 20, 30 years before that, he writes The Girl with the Hungry Eyes, which is all about the role of advertising in the modern urban environment. And it's like my second favorite vampire story ever.
What's your first?
Carmilla.
I don't know that.
Carmilla is Sheridan Le Fanu. It's one of the definitive gothic vampire stories. It's one of the inspirations on Dracula, although it's a much more rural story than Dracula.
So, Jamie, you were talking about how marketing, you and Greg were talking about how marketing had essentially created the category of urban fantasy.
Well, I mean, marketing has created most of the categories that we deal with now. And you look at the YA genre, that's largely marketing speak. So you run into the problem then. And this is actually something I love, the way that urban fantasy, Angry Robot, can be shelved under category on its back covers. That is fantastic. But if you sit and look at it, it also gives you a really good look at how nebulous the boundaries of any given subgenre can be.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things I was going to point out is that when I decided I wanted to read Interview with a Vampire, I couldn't find it in the bookstore because it's under literature.
Yeah. And actually, I wanted, Rose, you have such a history with vampire in particular. I wanted to see if you would talk a little bit about the influence of the vampire novel and how the gothic and urban fantasy subgenres have kind of melded into each other, especially in the last probably 10 or 15 years.
Well, how early do you want me to start historically?
You know, a light overview of its history, I guess, it would be a good way to put it.
All right. Well, because I think back in the era of the Gothic, you've got things like Carmilla, which are very definitively Gothic. But then you've got Dracula, which is an ultra-modern thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It uses high technology, things like blood transfusions. It's set in for a great deal in modern London and contrasts modern London with the distant parts of Europe. It's about, in the early parts, it's about a modern Londoner traveling through parts of Europe that are culturally quite different from the milieu he's used to. So Dracula is really, to me, that's the first point where the Gothic starts being contemporized. You also see some of that in Frankenstein. But to stick to
I thought it was Frankenstein.
Which side is your hump on?
Just call me Igor.
But then you also see when you start getting into the 70s, the deconstruction, and maybe the 60s, I'm not actually sure when one of these books was published, you start getting into the deconstructive vampire books. Interview with a Vampire is, of course, the most famous, but there's also Fred Saberhagen's The Dracula Tape. And these deconstructive vampire novels, I think, are ancestral to what we look at now as urban fantasy, the sort of cross-pollination of urban fantasy and gothic horror. And where those two come together very much is in 1991 in Vampire the Masquerade, which is on one level a game about modern magic and on another level a game about social horror.
And on another level, a really, really crappy Fox television show.
You know, I will argue that although that was not a very good show, it has some standout moments.
Yeah?
Yeah. Probably not best to get into that right now because that's sort of a diversion, but I think actually that Kindred the Embraced has some good moments as a vampire drama.
Hmm.
You know, Rose makes an interesting connection between the time period, the contemporary nature of urban fantasy. And maybe it's actually what distinguishes urban fantasy is that it's non-nostalgic the way so much of the rest of fantasy is. You know, our secondary worlds tend to have a sort of historical sort of construction, you know, whether it's medieval or Renaissance or whatever. And even if it's not necessarily European, there's a sort of European flavor.
Sure.
You know, or there's with urban fantasy, what we are just seeing is it's actually just contemporary fantasy. It's just fantasy that actually takes place in our current time and place. And so much of our existence now is urban that by definition, fantasy that takes place in contemporary time is almost always going to be urban fantasy. You know, there's a series of books by Deb Coates out from Tor Books, and they take place in rural South Dakota. And nobody knows what to call it. You know, it's contemporary. Takes place in the South. So people are calling it rural urban fantasy.
Well, and that's one of the things that I brought up. You know, if you write a book in the hills and hollers of Kentucky, does it count as urban fantasy?
And it shouldn't because it's not urban. Right. On the other hand, it should because it's not all the other things that urban fantasy is not. So I think marketing categories are great because they help you find the books readers want to read and they sort of give you at least a general idea of what that book is. But when that definition fails, we kind of flail trying to decide what to call stuff.
Yeah, and then we start making new categories.
Yeah, I'm very happy to bring back contemporary fantasy in the cases where the very specifically urban label just doesn't work. And there are BISEC codes for both urban and contemporary fantasy. So like there is the ability from a back end standpoint to make a differentiation there, but they tend to come in clusters. When I'm coding an urban fantasy book for Angry Robot, it tends to be urban and contemporary and a third category, so that they tend to go together for me.
Sure.
Well, yeah, right there with you.
And it's cool that you do that, like James said, because it gives the book buyer at the bookstore a choice. You know, they've got different places they can put that book because it's going to appeal to different audiences, different readers.
I worked for a company for a while that was really allergic to the term urban fantasy. So I just called it all paranormal drama,
yeah,
which seemed to go over pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good wide term for it.
My understanding, though, is that paranormal has come to describe so many books, it's its own subgenre, and that in YA, currently agents don't want anything to be described as paranormal.
That's interesting.
So you can use supernatural now, but you can't use paranormal.
And I've seen, I get a lot of books. And I have seen stuff labeled as YA, but I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, this is just urban fantasy.
Well, so YA is one of the bigger...
Things. Yeah, they're trying to push things into the YA category now.
Yeah, because YA is an age category that acts like a genre but really isn't.
Yes.
Even though, but there are category-based tropes and tendencies that behave for me like genre tropes, which is a different panel Jane can have later.
Yes, well, I am actually starting to run out of the pitches that I sent them. So, you know, keep those ideas coming.
Cool.
But
this reminds me.
Go ahead.
I have anthology ideas, Jane.
No. Okay. Charles is bad enough. You do not get to contribute. Anyways.
Greg's last comment kind of reminded me of a great quote that that I heard when I was talking with Shauna McGuire, probably at FogCon or Phoenix Comic Con or sometime this year. And that she talks about writing urban fantasy because all of the big kind of folkloric influences on her, and I apologize, Shannon, if I'm misquoting you, so please correct me, that all of the influences were authors who were writing about the fantastic in their world. You know, Shakespeare was writing about the fantastic in his age, and that urban fantasy is just our version of writing the fantastic into the world we know, which I think Greg had gestured toward.
Well, so in that case, how does urban fantasy relate to other kinds of urban fiction?
Who are you asking?
Anybody.
Michael?
Urban fiction in terms of like noir or?
Well, that would be a great example. I mean, like how do you, I think you can see a definite relationship between the detective genre and a large quantity of what you see as urban fantasy on the shelves right now. The paranormal detective is almost a cliche at this point, but I think there's a lot taken from noir detective fiction that you see, and its portrayal of the city that you see developed in urban fantasy.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and it's sort of like the bridge is kind of like dark fantasy, because urban mm-hmm. fantasy does tend to have this sort of seedy underside, or at least a dark or possibly, you know, edging into a horror element. And it seems when it does that, it's definitely resonating with noir. So you add noir and you add magic, and it's almost as if right then you've got two categories that you could combine in sort of in a facile way, but still not necessarily invalid, call that urban fantasy.
Yeah, and well, I think any... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say to hang my bias on my sleeve here. My latest vampire role-playing game starts out, the frontispiece is an extended quote from Raymond Chandler's The Little Sister.
There you go.
You're not human tonight. So that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, and I like to think of genres, when we're, you know, especially if we're talking about the long conversation, that at any given time, there tend to be loci, which have relative gravity within a genre, and that certain works then with that greater gravity kind of attract other works and create a path that people move into, so that, you know, Dresden Files comes and it succeeds a whole bunch. And then that creates a comparable title that other books can be sold based on. It said, well, this is like Dresden Files, but X, and that success breeds success. And you know, a first book is cool and distinct. A second book is a little bit different. And when you get into the third through the 10th book, suddenly you've got a subtrend.
Michael, it's almost like you read my query letter.
My fear is that once we have some conspicuous and expensive failures in a subgenre, then that subgenre becomes dead. And books that don't necessarily fit like really cleanly into that model, you know, like not that this would ever happen, but let's just say Jim Butcher in a parallel universe is an utter failure. And then books that aren't really that much like Jim, I know it's fantasy, all right? And books that really aren't that much like his work would get lumped in with that work. And because they're similar enough, are not going to be considered marketable. And that to me is the danger of a genre label. You know, nobody's going to say that contemporary fantasy can't work, but somebody could easily say like urban fantasy no longer works. We're not buying it anymore.
Well, we see that happen all the time. No, we see that happen all the time. And that's one of the places where the smaller and mid-list houses can be really good in helping to preserve a genre, you know, when it's going through its unpopular phase. It's, you know, and it makes sense. New York runs very big numbers and they have to be able to sustain that. It's just unfortunate for a genre that, you know, gets that stigma put on it, but it happens all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, two and a half years ago, I actually did secure a literary agent who was shopping my urban fantasy around and was told repeatedly by the big houses that they weren't buying urban fantasy right now. They were looking for space opera.
Yeah.
And they were looking for epic fantasy because that's what they felt the trend was, and that's what they wanted to buy and have on hand so that in 2 years, you know, they could have those books out. So I see that all the time.
And that's sad for readers.
It's sad for readers, it's sad for authors too.
Yeah, because it's not like urban fantasy is dropping off. There's still tons of readers. There's still tons of people out there wanting the new books. It's just, you know, the publishing industry does have to watch trends and try to figure out what's coming next, you know. And I've joked before on the podcast, when WorldCon in Chicago, when was that? That was just a couple
years ago.
Yeah.
At the bar there, I overheard several conversations of editors and agents and different people talking to writers going, well, what we're really looking for right now is bondage. Bondage is in because 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, well, we're looking for bondage stories. And you're going, what? What the hell are you talking about?
When did that become a category, people?
Well, I think something we've seen happen now is that in addition to the smaller houses kind of picking up some of the slack when the major five houses kind of get distracted by ooh shiny trends somewhere else, mm-hmm. is that indie authors are publishing into subcategories that are not sexy. In terms of being the big marketing appeal and doing quite well. You know, it seems like there's always been a ceiling on superhero fiction, but I know of a number of superhero authors who are in the indie sphere who seem to have gotten quite a good following. Mm-hmm. And I think if we see urban fantasy become even more unpopular, and that not only do editors stop buying some, they stop buying way more, we'll probably see more of it pop up in the indie sphere.
Could we back up, though? Is that actually, I mean, we're kind of, is urban fantasy unpopular now?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
It's harder to sell and start a new series.
Yes.
Is what I've heard over the last year and a half, because there are long-running, very successful series, but that's a known quantity. You know, the Dresden Files is already a proven ticket. You know, Kelly Armstrong series is already a proven ticket.
Comparisons, which is over now.
And that is almost verbatim what the responses that I got with mine. It's like, we're not going to start a new series right now. It's just not going to happen.
The other unfortunate thing, and this happens with every single subgenre, is that you have something that is a breakout success that, you know, has probably been doing fairly well for a while, but all of a sudden you have one thing that just really hits the market super hard. So, in the rush to have as much of that to satisfy reader need as possible, the market gets oversaturated. Editors start buying books that maybe are not up to snuff, but they need something to push out to keep that demand fed. And then as readers start picking up these books that they're, you know, they're using to fill say, you know, until the next Dresden book comes out. Mm-hmm. They're buying stuff that is not quite up to what they would usually do. So you just start ending up with this slow spiral towards a lower standard, oversaturation, and reader burnout. And that happens in every subgenre, and then it goes quiet for a while, and then there's another breakout half the time in the indie market. I mean, look at epic fantasy. That resurgence largely came out of the indie market, along with, you know, some of the big grimdark titles. And that happens every time. I think the same thing probably, Rose may completely slap me down on this, but in gaming and in movies, in every single place, demand equals oversaturation within a fairly measurable length of time. Now, zombies would just hit that level.
Well, gaming is a slightly different dynamic because right now, role-playing gaming is so dominated by tiny indie publishers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a very different dynamic in terms of genre saturation and things like that.
Who do you define as an indie role-playing game publisher?
Well, almost everybody at this point. 10 years ago, there were a couple of big role-playing publishing houses. I worked for White Wolf. Well, White Wolf doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now the White Wolf lines are carried on by a company I also work for, Onyx Path, which is an indie publisher.
Right.
And which is how we know each other.
Yeah, which is how we know each other. Jame and I got introduced at the Onyx Path booth this year by a mutual friend. And we're working on some projects for OP together. But, you know, all of the short of, and I don't want to get too much into the industry itself, but short of Wizards of the Coast and Paizo, practically everybody's an indie publisher. And so that's a very different dynamic from fiction publishing, where there are still a number of large powerhouse publishers.
Dominant publishers, yes.
Dominant publishers. Now, what I would say, though, skipping back to something you were saying a minute ago, Jame, is about genres going in and out. One thing I've noticed in the time that I've been involved as a attempted writer and then an actual writer in the vampire space is that vampires have gone in and out of style twice.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, there was the early 90s vampire explosion, of which Vampire the Masquerade was very much a part. And then there's your more recent Twilight and Sookie Stackhouse vampire explosion.
I think I just barfed in my mouth a little bit.
Well, you know, I...
We are 12.
I am still 100% Twilight free.
Where to start on Twilight?
I'm 100% Twilight free.
I don't like Twilight, but I actually have a tremendous amount of respect for where it's gone in the genre.
Yes.
And I've got an essay on my website called Vampires. What is it called? Vampires Don't Suck, Deal With It. About how we go through these waves of sympathetic vampires being introduced into pop culture and getting panned as not real vampires, but then making a large dent. And then we go back towards really monstrous, really unidentifiable vampires for a couple of years. And then we're back at sympathetic vampires again. And it's a loop. Mm. And Twilight is a part of the latest cycle through that loop.
Well, one of the questions I actually wanted to bring up was, urban fantasy is one of those things that I believe is really good, in various forms of media. One of those big vampire phases was brought on by shows like Buffy. You know, so you look at some of the big, essentially geek powerhouse media stuff, and it's largely urban fantasy. Angel was a very successful spinoff. You have a ton of seasons of True Blood. I mean, I don't even know how many
seasons of that.
Okay. So you look at the fantasy and SF-based visual media, I guess is the way to put it, and you pretty much have either urban fantasy or more on the SF side. And yeah, a lot of it is really, really bad. but we also have some of those huge breakout hits that are what really bring in people's attention. And so that's kind of why I'm referring to urban fantasy as a gateway drug, because it's still people you can identify with, even if you're not a born geek, you haven't been in the industry for 15 years. It's a way to kind of ease in if you're interested.
Sure. And congratulations to Nicholas Brendan on his recent marriage.
Oh, well, good for him.
Xander got married, people.
No, I'll try. I'm not going to cry.
Was there a question in all that, James?
Well, what I wanted to ask was, what are some of the shows that have really been, besides Buffy, been some of the things that have brought people into the genre and have kind of transformed the direction that modern speculative fiction is going?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've got a theory.
Oh, dear.
That it's a demon. A dancing demon. No, something isn't right there. Greg, why don't you answer?
So many things aren't right there.
Thanks for that segue. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the advantage of urban fantasy, I mean, I enjoy it just because of its intrinsic charms. And, you know, I enjoyed urban fantasy before I think that was even being used as a popular
term. Hipster.
Just made myself a hipster comment. Wow. Look at my handlebar mustache. I'm going to get some wax. But it's relatable. You don't have to explain. You have to explain some of the specifics of the world within that particular fictional universe. But you don't have to explain the map. You know, you don't have to explain what country this is or what world this is or, you know, what the political structure is. Urban fantasy comes for a general audience with a lot of ease of entry. It's comfortable. So it makes sense to me that among the really popular franchises, you know, you're going to have a lot of urban fantasy. And, you know, vampires have never gone away. And part of that is, you know, in a contemporary setting too. And I think part of that popularity in pop culture is because not only do you not have to explain the world, you don't even have to explain the monster. You know, you don't even have to explain what the fantasy trope or element is. It's a familiarity. And so I think within that, people are comfortable, they're on board, and then you can just focus on making it cool for a general audience. I think with urban fantasy, sometimes in print, there might be an overemphasis on trying to find what the new trick is, what's the new spin, you know, because yes, you're dealing with so much insider baseball. Oh, it's a vampire, but what makes this vampire so different? And is that necessarily the best use of creative storytelling energies to find that one particular, like, unique or not completely overexposed element?
But at the same time, you'll have publishers and editors going, what's your unique spin? What's your different thing? What are you doing that's not like everybody else?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, publishing is weird.
Yeah.
It's really hard to sell a book.
And the people, yeah, and people that work in publishing, they're just people like anybody else, and their jobs are on the line. They don't necessarily have, you know, this great, huge global plan to make stuff awesome. They're just trying to find one thing that will sell a moderate number of copies and allow them to, you know, continue to stay in business.
Well, I disagree. I think there is a global plan. Hail Hydra. Michael.
Well, I think, like, as one of the guys who has to be the person to try and sell a book, because I present to the Random House people who present to all the bookstores. So if we get a book in at Angry Robot that's a incredibly competent fantasy 101, I have to sell it on that accessibility. And if I get a book in that's really distinct, I can sell it on the distinctiveness. But if I'm selling a well-done book that doesn't innovate into a market that's pretty full, it's incredibly hard to find a way to make that book stand apart. And I think that has some influence on the way that editors develop their urban fantasy lists, as with really any other subgenre.
Well, but I do think that familiarity that Greg was talking about has value, and I think this ties into what Jane was saying about a gateway drug. Mm-hmm. As an editor or developer, as we usually call it in my business, I have a rule that I inflict on people, which is called the 1954 rule, which is, if you cannot explain to me a version of your story that takes place in 1954, you don't have a story. You need to be able to strip a certain amount of cruft off of any premise and present it as a story that takes place between characters that people can relate to in a relatively recent historical milieu. 1954 is an arbitrary year, but you know, I think you need to be able to create a relatable story that people can understand, even if they aren't on board with all of the unique bits of your particular world building, which are then selling points for your story.
James?
Oops. Oh, I was opening my mouth. Give me time. Give me a moment to talk here. Sheesh.
Well, I mean, we could talk about 1954 if you wanted.
And now you have completely driven what I was going to say out of my mind.
And Greg left. So the Soviet Union ceases to demand war reparations from East Germany on January 1 in 1954.
I also just have to briefly say that the discussion right now is making me so happy because I was one of those kids who grew up in a household that was absolutely terrified of Dungeons and Dragons, and God only knows, you know, what would have happened if they'd figured out about White Wolf, the demon, and everything.
You know, it's funny because I grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons, and you had all those stories. And I was in a Catholic household, which I think we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. No one cared.
I went to Catholic school, and no one cared. My introduction to gaming, I kid you not, was from Chick Tracks.
I wrote fanfic for Dark Dungeons.
I kind of want to see this.
I can send it to you, Jam. I wrote Femslash for Dark Dungeons.
Please do. That will make my year.
Jam.
What?
New anthology idea.
No.
No, seriously. No, role playing fan fiction fake stories.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Danger, danger, warning, warning.
Coming from my perspective, that sounds way too navel-gazing.
Yeah, I'm kind of stuck in this infinite loop right now with a lot of scary things. Okay. That could be a kind of dangerous thing. I am sure that many of them would love to write fan fiction about their own games that would be kind of hilarious, but would probably be too many inside jokes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so one of the things that I want to make sure that we get to is some of the shakers in the new urban fantasy and modern
fiction. Someone's at the door.
So besides people like Greg and Rose and Michael, who are some of the people writing some really great stuff right now? And I'll lead off with a fairly easy one. And of course, I completely lost his name. That was really, really sad. I'm going to let other people talk about this.
What about Maurice Broaddus writing the King Arthur in the urban setting?
And that's actually a really good example because that is extremely innovative, just in the way that it was done with this. So basically, for people who are not familiar with it, Maurice wrote a great series for Angry Robot that is set on the streets of Indianapolis, and it has a homeless kid who is the reincarnation of King Arthur. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition of tropes and stories, so it's definitely worth checking out.
And if you don't know Maurice Broaddus, you and I need to have a conversation. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Greg? So, other people, yes.
I would push Kevin Hearn.
Thank you. That's the name I was trying to think of.
Oh, sure.
So you're talking about the Iron Druid.
The Iron Druid series, which takes place. The first one, Hounded, mm-hmm. takes place in Tempe, Arizona, which is strange because I lived in Tempe, Arizona. So reading it about like the pubs were in the comic book store was all really familiar to me. And he deals with Norse mythology and Celtic mythology, and it's just a lot of huge fun and eyeball kicks. If you know Kevin, he's an extremely likable guy.
He is.
An extremely ebullient, energetic, likable guy. And he's one of those cases where the stuff he writes is so reflected in the kind of guy who he is that I would just call this series fun and energetic and likable.
And he writes the best Irish wolfhound.
I love his Irish wolfhound. I want to get an Irish wolfhound. Yeah. It's of course, it's an intelligent Irish wolfhound.
Yes.
I'm gonna throw some stuff in the middle between calling on you guys. I'm going to also say, oh my gosh, Jim Hines, Liebermancer.
Yes.
Liebermancer. Michael.
Yeah, so there's really way too many. So I'm gonna jump back and forth between Angry Robot picks, so I'm not a total shill. I want to start out with Jay Wells' Prospero's War series, which is very much like The Wire, but with magic, in a fictional kind of Rust Belt town, where instead of the war on drugs, you have the war on magic, and there's dirty magic that people cook like meth in the cauldron.
That sounds like fun.
Is the bad like magic gang neighborhood in the city, and you have a main character who is kind of from that world and has gotten out and then has to go back into it. And it's got a lot of the strongest elements of crime fiction and strong thriller pacing. And it just, when I read the first book, Dirty Magic, it really felt fresh, not in a way that was like, that meant it was truly different from urban fantasy. It just was a really excellently mixed version of something that was somewhat familiar, but with that crime element, not in a noir fashion, but straight up crime fiction, turned up in a pretty good way. We've already mentioned Chuck Wendig. He has not only the Miriam Black series, starts with Blackbirds,
which is amazing.
But it's more rural rather than urban, even with some of the flavor. His Mookie Pearl series, first book is The Blue Blazes, is truly urban because it's set in New York, about the mythic monstrous underworld fighting the kind of mundane magic, the mundane gangster underworld, and you have one character who strides those two worlds.
Very cool. And I'll throw it out there, we can argue whether or not she's new, but Shauna McGuire.
Yes,
doing some wonderful stuff. Rose, anything on your radar?
This is actually a couple years back, but one of my favorite writers and game designers is Greg Stolze, and he did a novel, I guess, about 3 years ago now called Switch Flipped, which is an absolutely amazing take on modern magic. But what I like about it isn't so much the magic, but the characters and the way he flips between their perspectives. He uses multiple voices and tenses throughout the novel, and creates a really interesting texture exploring his magical premise very much through the lens of some very, very different people.
I mentioned Deborah Coates' Wide Open series, and it's a trilogy, and it just completed this late this spring. It's about Hallie Boyd, who is a sergeant in the U.S. Army and serving in Afghanistan. And she dies briefly. She's one of those people that, you know, is resuscitated after being technically dead for a brief period of time. She goes home to her hometown in South Dakota to attend the funeral of a friend of hers. And she can now see ghosts. So she can see who the dead are. And it's sort of a murder mystery with a lot of large-scale supernatural stakes. Just her level of prose is the kind of restrained writing that I wish I could manage, that I really can't. I think it's kind of been overlooked because it's quiet. And instead of banter, she has laconic characters, which in urban fantasy is really rare. And I think it's totally worth seeking out if you're looking for something just a little different.
Yeah.
I'm also going to add Richard Codrey is one of my absolute favorites. And he's been doing the Sandman Slim series for a while, but he, Kim Harrison, and Patricia Biggs are three that I will buy anything that comes out. But another one that is not really something that people would necessarily think, but interestingly, there are a couple of religious authors who, if you read it as straight urban fantasy and not as religious fantasy, Ted Decker does some really great stuff. And then Christopher Golden did a fantastic vampire Catholic Church series that it was a little while ago, but it kind of seems to have fallen off the radar, and I love it.
So, James, I have a question that's going to blow the lid off this whole thing.
Okay.
Does urban fantasy? So why? Okay. We're gonna go down the political thing here.
You're breaking your own law.
I know I am. We talk a lot within the community about balance, right? And mm-hmm. between Western authors and Eastern authors and different kinds of mythologies and this and that, right? We talk mm-hmm. about female writers, we talk about male writers, we talk about all that. Is urban fantasy, is it a place where there are just more female writers?
I think that there's...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But I think that it's actually fairly even right now. Just in looking at the series that are coming out and that I have seen on my radar recently, I think it's about a 50-50. One of the things that I really, really love about urban fantasy, though, is that it is starting to really branch out and draw in a lot of different settings and cultures. There's some amazing urban fantasy set in, right. Particularly in Asian cultures that I'm really enjoying, and I am so drawing a blank on that right now.
But it feels almost like it's an open canvas.
Yes.
Was it Snake Agent, the Liz Williams series from a few years back?
I think so.
Because that one's like, it's urban fantasy, mystery, and science fiction. It was a great mix.
Zen Cho is writing some really interesting short stories as well. I published one of hers back when I was editing cross genres that was fantastic. Australia is developing an amazing urban fantasy group of authors. So it's one of those things where, in a lot of ways, the more history you have in your city, the more you can really bring into your book. I mean, I've joked for a while that one of the things I really, really want to see is a Babylonian urban fantasy. I mean, that would just, if you went all out into the mythology of Babylon, it would create this amazing setting for it. But if you look at the cities we have, you know, if you write something set in Tokyo or even in Hawaii, where you're drawing in from the more traditional Hawaiian cultures, you have such a huge canvas to work with.
So it sounds like you're pitching that you want Howard Andrew Jones to write an urban fantasy in Babylon.
Yes,
because he did all that research.
Yes, Howard, if you're listening, please. Yes. No, I actually have. The historical urban fantasy anthology that's been kind of tabled for a while, but is something I really want to work on once all the other anthologies are done.
That sounds really cool.
Wouldn't it be fun? I mean, part of my problem is I want to write for it. I don't just want to edit it. I want to write for it. But yeah, I think that would be a really interesting, a potentially amazing anthology. I just need some time and, you know, a fellow victim to co-edit it with me.
So you talked about and you asked about new series and authors that are emerging. So mm-hmm. I want to know from the podcast members here, what's like your go-to series? What's the one that is still going on that you can't wait until the next book comes out? Michael.
I've been absolutely adoring Shannon's Encrypted series. Mm-hmm. Starts with Midnight Armageddon, and it has a lot of the kind of punchiness and the fun and the romance and the it's the flavor mix of urban fantasy that is most my aesthetic sweet spot as a reader. So I love to go back to that as much as I can. I also see influence from it from The Middleman, which is one of my favorite dearly departed urban fantasy TV shows.
The Middleman. Don't know that
one. Not actually familiar with that one.
Yeah. Don't know that one, Michael.
Please tell us.
So The Middleman is a phenomenal show that was created by Javier Grillo, Mark Swatch. It was originally a comic series co-created with Les McLean. And it is very much like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets the Men in Black, where it's incredibly arch and funny and snarky. All of the flavor in that area that you want from your urban fantasies, but with tons of kind of comic book physics and monsters and robots and aliens and things all thrown in. So it's this insane, crazy pants melange. The main character is a unfazable urban fantasy heroine type who has a tentacle alien erupt when she's doing temp work at a scientific lab. And every episode in this TV series kind of has an urtext. So there's one that's basically Die Hard in a building, and they make tons of Die Hard references. And there's one that features a Asian Kung Fu master wearing a luchador mask against a group of evil lucha libre wrestlers. And it's just gloriously insane, and I recommend it to anyone.
That reminds me of the luchador episode of Angel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever saw that. That was a great one.
Yeah.
Rose, same question to you.
Well, I think Mike Carey isn't quite done with the Felix Castro novels, although it's been a long time since we've had a new one, and I will pick that up as soon as it comes out.
What about you, Greg?
I'm still interested in T.A. Pratt, who's, you know, also known as Tim Pratt.
Yes.
His Marla Mason series. There were, I think, 4 or 5 books that were published by Random House before the 98 Random House implosion, but he's continued them with Kickstarter, with crowdfunded books and with short stories and novellas.
And I'm actually enjoying the ones that he's been crowdfunding probably more, because I feel like he has a little more leeway to do what he wanted to do.
Yeah, also, I think he's drawing on this sort of now what's becoming sort of a deep and rich history that the characters have amongst themselves. So I think that's one of the advantages of like new publishing models. You know, the big New York couldn't make any money with them anymore, or not enough money. But there are still tons of fans who are really still just interested in these characters. Mm-hmm. And so Tim's been able to keep it going. So you can start. Gosh, I can't remember the name of the first one right now, but that's what Google's for. So.
Mm-hmm. James,
they're still in print.
What about you, James?
I kind of brought them up, but Kim Harrison's urban fantasy series is something that it's kind of hard to state what's really, really good about it, I think, because it's a very subtly done series in that it's enjoyable to read, but it also kind of breaks a lot of things. And she's one of the people who has really managed to nail a super powerful main character who's also not just Mary Sueing her way through everything or getting out of scrapes that there's no way she could, you know, she should be able to get out of. There are real consequences. There's real complexity to the series. And it is just really one of the best examples of the genre, I think. I also quite enjoy Ilona Andrews, possibly because I bear a grudge toward Atlanta. And, you know, seeing it in a post-apocalyptic state makes me really happy.
So you lived in Atlanta, too.
No, I just travel down there often enough to remember why I hate it so much. It takes the Dragon Con for me to know why I hate it.
I lived in Atlanta for 7 or 8 years, and I couldn't stand it until I moved into my last apartment there, and then I really learned to love it. I was missing the right neighborhood.
And then you had to move, of course.
And then I had to move.
I lived in Chattanooga for a couple of years, and I used to drive down to Atlanta. I never really had a problem with Atlanta. I would be on the bypass doing the speed limit, and the cops would be passing me at 75 miles an hour, honking their horns and telling me to speed up. It's like, oh. Well,
driving in Atlanta is both the only way to get around and the worst form of torture.
Yeah, yeah. That bypass is just crazy.
They also have a really strange affinity for the steepest, longest escalators I have ever seen.
Like, well, that's fucking Dragon Con.
At the Atlanta airport is the same thing. I had to transfer between terminals when I was coming back from Houston. And I got on it, and I was having flashbacks to Dragon Con because the ones in the Atlanta airport are exactly the same as the MARTA stop up to Dragon Con. And, I mean, I don't have a fear of heights. I climbed Angel's Landing in Zion, which has a 1,000-foot sheer drop-off on the side of it, and I was fine. These escalators give me a fear of heights and vertigo.
James, I was just in Boston for a Wicked Smart conference that they had there. And I had an incident with an escalator where the escalator, the landing essentially turned into a mosh pit because there were so many people on the escalator going up and then trying to make a sharp right turn to go up to the next floor that there was a bottleneck right there and everybody just kind of got smooshed together.
Yeah, escalators aren't really something that you can just wait for people to get off.
They're like, hey, stop coming up. It's like, you can't. The escalator's moving. What the hell?
Yeah, or the people who just kind of pause at the very end of the escalator and you're like, buddy, this is going to be really rude, but I'm employing my... I have spent many years working in nightclubs. I know how to move people out of my way, and you're about to go tumbling like a bowling pin.
So we've had most of these people, except for Greg, who was late. Loser. And so we've had most of these people on for about an hour now. We need to start wrapping this up. What's some of your final things that you wanted to talk about?
Mostly what people are working on now, since we do have some really interesting urban fantasy people here. And, you know, what are the things that we would like to see come out of the genre that maybe are just getting touched on or haven't been touched on enough?
Rose, you want to get us started on that?
Well, what I'm working on right now is another vampire book. And this one is, yeah, I know, it's what I do. This one is a bunch of artifacts, a bunch of documents from inside the world of vampires. And I'm pretty excited about that because I really like getting an inside view of the supernatural as if it were a real subculture or a real set of subcultures. I like That's digging awesome. Into that. And it's something I've had the chance to do a couple of other times in my career. And I really just love dealing with supernatural creatures and the people who love them as communities. Mm-hmm. And so it's really exciting to be able to do a book like this. It's called Secrets of the Covenant. It's for the Vampire the Requiem role-playing game, but it's primarily a fiction anthology. And it should be coming out later this year.
Very cool. Michael, what are you working on now that Lee's taken a vacation and left you?
Well, on the Angry Robot side, we've got Ferret Steinmetz's Flex, which is going to be one of our first books when we come back in the spring. We've got more books booked in for the Mookie Pearl series and another one that's about to be announced, which I'm very excited about but can't talk about yet.
Why not?
Because it still has to be signed.
Don't you love me?
I do love you, but I love keeping my job even more. I'm sorry, man. For my own stuff, I'm working on Hexamancy, which is the third Rhi Reyes novel, which kind of takes a lot of the stuff from the first couple of books and the novella and makes it all come back around. And this is the fandom and geekdom is a magic system. So a little bit of what Rose was saying in terms of magic and magical people as a subculture.
So
in terms of stuff, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
Stuff I'd like to see is I'm hoping that we'll see even more kind of diversity in terms of representation in the genre and diversity in the places in the world that get to be magical, exciting settings. You know, we've seen lots of New York and Chicago and LA and that these are great settings because a lot of people are familiar, but I think there's a specific locative coolness to any given place that you can dig into. And if 50 people have done it before, maybe you don't get as much to play with.
And there's this amazing thing called Google Maps. So if you aren't sure how a place works, you can bring it up on Google Maps.
You know, I don't think anybody's done a really great urban fantasy series set in DC. And as a DC native, that's something I'd really love to... Well, I'd like somebody else to do it so I can read it. But maybe it's something I need to carve out for myself. I don't know.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned setting because the books that I've written were set in Denver. And I was told by one editor, and I found this kind of amusing, sorry, editors, but they said, look, you can't have an urban fantasy in Denver. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because Cary Vaughn's already done it. And I said, so what you're saying is you can never have another urban fantasy set in Chicago because of Jim Butcher. Yeah. What? What? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. No. And I was just curious, Michael, do you think that Lee is going to become a New Yorker?
I don't think so. I think he'll travel there here and there. Chicago was the city I remember him speaking most fondly of from WorldCon a couple years ago.
Yeah, but here's the problem. Lee doesn't believe that chicken and waffles exist. He thinks that I'm pulling his leg, and I'm not.
Well, it's a real thing. He clearly hasn't lived in Atlanta.
Exactly.
I look forward to his dreams being crushed and to him understanding just how awful humanity can be. Did I say that out loud?
You did. That's okay, though. Greg?
Let's see. I'm continuing or finishing my California Bones series. The first one just came out in June, and then the second book, Pacific Fire, comes out in January, and then I'm working on trying to figure out a title for the third one, because that comes out in September, so I better hurry up on that. What I would like to see is I would actually like to see epic fantasy taking place in contemporary settings. Mm-hmm. So epic urban fantasy, whatever that is. And if nobody writes that, then I'm fully willing to commit myself to it as long as a publisher is willing to, you know, pay me a little bit of money.
Call me.
Okay. All right.
Actually, that would make a pretty awesome game.
I would really like to see somebody take urban fantasy and cross it with sort of the dying earth genre. I'm envisioning.
You know who you need to read? Mark Sharan Newton.
Email me that name.
I will.
I would love to.
Because he was directly inspired by, and so this is someone that I'll go ahead and give a shout out to as well. Mark is a fantastic author, and he did a trilogy of books. All three of them are epic fantasy, heavily inspired by The Dying Earth. But what was really cool was that each of the three had a different subgenre, but was set within the same city. So he did one that was that had all of the tropes of noir, an epic fantasy in an urban setting, superheroes, and then I forget what the third one was. So it was a couple of years ago, but you probably will love his stuff, so I'll email that to you.
That sounds great. I was thinking, you know, one of my favorite David Bowie songs is 5 years, and there's this sense of fatalism about the world ending, which is just fantastic, and I would love to see that fused with some of the things we love about urban fantasy.
That would be cool.
That would be cool.
So a Bowie concept album of urban fantasy. Please, someone make that.
Right on. All righty. So is there anything else, Jane, before I let these folks go?
Nope. I think the consensus is pretty good that we would like to see a lot more other settings. Personally, I would absolutely love to see some more Middle Eastern settings. That's kind of my favorite sort of place to look at.
I've been trying to squeeze Dubai into Vampire for years.
Ooh, that would be awesome. G. Willow Wilson did A Leaf the Unseen, which is kind of urban fantasy, that is set in the Middle East, and it is an absolutely beautiful book. But I would really like to see some more of that is not just... I think maybe one of the things to be careful of there is that it's not just an American goes and saves the Middle East.
Yeah.
But some actually from Middle Eastern authors would be amazing.
You don't want a Jack Ryan book with vampires?
No.
No?
I love Tom Clancy's stuff. I've read a lot of it. No.
Well, here's the thing. Even though he's passed on, apparently Jack Ryan is going to live on.
Yes.
It's a brand now, like James Patterson.
It's been a brand for quite a while, actually.
Yeah, but not with the Ryan books, which is just sad.
Well, a friend of mine used to have the job title lead Clancy writer at Ubisoft.
I know who you're talking about.
Rich Dansky. He's a phenomenal guy.
Yes. Yeah, he writes some pretty good urban fantasy, too.
He does.
He's working on a big game right now as well.
Yes, he is working on Wraith the Oblivion 20th Anniversary Edition for my frequent client, Onyx Path.
Very cool. All
right. Well, that should be really awesome and depressing.
Well, we better wrap this up so that some people can go eat dinner and other people can go to bed. Jane, why don't you tell people about War Stories? Where can they find it and all that good stuff?
So War Stories will be available on Amazon. It's out through Apex Publishing, so it will be going live on that site again soon. We've been sending out a lot of review copies, and so far no one has hated us, which worries me a little bit. But it will be coming out at the beginning of next week. and it is in both ebook and hardcover form. And in fact, if you want the ebook, that's already live on Apex Publishing. So cool. It's a collection of stories about the future of war, and it has some people we've mentioned tonight, like, well, Rich Dansky, Jay Posey, and a bunch of other really great authors.
Congratulations on getting that out, by the way.
Thank you.
Are you taking any submissions for any sequel anthologies that I may have talked you into doing?
You wish you could talk me into doing those.
That's a no?
That sounded kind of no-ish to me.
Yeah, it sounded like a no. Yeah.
No, that is a hell no.
Michael, do you want to remind people where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, michaelrunderwood.com, Mike R. Underwood on Twitter. And my new supernatural thriller, The Younger Gods, hits on October 13th for all ebook platforms. Audio coming soon.
Greg, same thing?
Yeah, writingandsnacks.com, Twitter at Greg Van Eekhout. Don't forget the silent H. And my books, California Bones, and my other books can be found generally wherever books are sold.
Rose?
FantasyHeartbreaker.com and Rose Bailey on Google Plus.
Very cool. Well, thanks to everyone for coming on tonight. I really appreciate it. James, thanks for wrangling all the cats.
And you being the hardest of those to wrangle, as usual.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't deny it.
No, you. I think you glory in it.
I do. All right. Well, thanks, folks. And everybody should go read an urban fantasy book or play an urban fantasy game, preferably.
Or hug an urban fantasy author.
Yes. And preferably one of the ones that have been on tonight.
Just not me, because I get stabby when people hug me.
She does. Yes.
I like ice cream. Give ice cream to an urban fantasy author.
There we go.
Well, that begs the question, though, Greg. What would you do for a Klondike bar?
Anything. Oh.
That's the point where we definitely need to stop the podcast.
All righty. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF and F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.